we do too many bills as a legislature. We have too many people on too many committees, which stretches people way too thin. I'm among a group of people that are going to advocate for reducing the bill quota. And then I've been sort of a vocal advocate within my caucus to say, like, hey, you know, people don't need to be on five committees, right? And there might be too much. And we don't need to have committees that have 17 people on them, because that creates a tremendous burden for advocates to get to a majority of those people.
I'm excited to share with you today my fantastic discussion with Senator Josh Newman, representing the 29th Senatorial District. The senator and I riff on the nuances of the legislative process, what it means to get lawmakers' attention when there are over 2,000 bills introduced every year. We delve into the appropriations process, the mysterious suspense file, and finally the budget process, and how all of this works in real life and what advocates need to know. As always, I hope that you find this conversation valuable. I am thankful to the senator for his time. This is Christina Boss Hamilton. You are listening to the Blueprint for California Advocates podcast.
Navigating the California legislative process can be frustrating and overwhelming. The path to creating policy change in Sacramento is complicated and lined with logistical and political potholes. Unless you live and breathe life at the Capitol, chances are you don't even know where to start. That is why I'm so happy to share with you my new book, Changemaker, an insider's guide to getting shit done at the California Capitol. This is a one-of-a-kind guide that demystifies California government and the legislative process into accessible, actionable steps with real-life advice to give you the confidence you need to step up and win. To check out my book, please go to the website www.kbhadvocacy.com/changemaker. You can pick up a copy online, or you can head to Capitol Books on K Street in downtown Sacramento.
Welcome, Senator Josh Newman. It is such an honor to have you on this episode. You represent the 29th Senatorial District, which is based in beautiful Orange County. I would love for you to take a moment and give us a little bit of background and how you landed in the California Senate.
Okay. Well, so it's an honor to be here. And so always, you and I have known each other for a long time, and we've been talking about this podcast for almost as long. I'm sitting in my office, which is in the city of Fullerton, and Fullerton is sort of dead center in the what is currently the 29th Senate District, which changes. We may get to that in this podcast. That changes in the next cycle. But I've been in office since 2016, got elected in a very close election. Then it was my first time running for legislative office. My background before
Gosh, I
that.
I can't believe it was that long ago. You're blowing
I know,
me away.
I know. Wow. I had at that time, I had an infant, and now I have a 7-year-old. Yeah. I've been doing this long enough that I have a second grader, and she's kind of grown up while I've been doing the elective service politics. So I, you know, my background really briefly is I'm a graduate of Yale University. I served after college as an officer in the United States Army. I got out in 1990, right before the first Gulf War. And my sort of post-service professional experience has been pretty varied. I worked in local government in San Francisco, worked in marketing, public relations, worked in the entertainment business for about 4 or 5 years down here in LA. And I worked in internet technology for about 15 years. Before doing this. In about 2012, I got very interested in the question about why young veterans, being a veteran myself, were having so much trouble upon their return to Southern California finding good jobs, right? Knowing vets as I knew them, and also taking into account all the challenges that they faced, but also the good service that they provided. I got very involved in the Orange County Veterans Advocacy Community, and through that wound up meeting a lot of our elected representatives, who always said wonderful things about veterans, but you know, there was a big gap between rhetoric and practice at that time. Mm-hmm. There still is. And so I, you know, kind of got frustrated enough that one night while I was griping about, you know, everybody says they want to do the right thing, but they don't. My wife, I think after having listened to me for too long, said something to the effect like, you know, hey, our state senator is termed out in 2016. If you really want to change things, maybe you should think about running. And she didn't.
It was your wife that
initiated. Well, she'll admit it. I mean, she'll admit it.
I'm sure now she's like, gosh, darn it.
She has regretted it many, many times since. And so that being kind of the idealist that I am, and if you think about elections for what they're supposed to be, how we as citizens hire the people who work for us in the public sphere. So I thought I had something to offer, and I was one of three candidates, and there were two Democrats, and I wasn't the Democratic Party's choice, but I kind of made my way through the primary. Then it was me and the Republican, then I wound up getting elected in a very, very close election. It was the closest election in the entire state that year. I was kind of stunned at how much attention it got, how much money kind of flowed through it. Yeah. And my election was so close, it wasn't actually called until after Thanksgiving, right? You know, it was 3 weeks. And then it also had the additional consequence of giving Democrats two-thirds majorities once again, both houses of the legislature, and that got a lot of attention. And that was really relevant when in April of the following year, you know, about 4 or 5 months into my tenure, the Senate voted for a bill to raise California's gas tax. It was called SB1. We all voted for that bill. 81 of us, there were 80 Democrats across two houses, one Republican, but I, because I'm from Orange County, I guess, and I'd won this very close election, I was singled out for a recall effort, and that turned out to be successful. So I was recalled or expelled in 2018, and then ran again for this office in 2020 and was elected or reelected, depending on how you think about it. So I actually have the weird distinction of being the only legislator in California state history to be recalled and to regain my seat. And that means either I really believe in public service and I've done a decent job, or I'm a glutton for punishment, or both of those things, I guess, at once. It's, you know, so you and I have known each other for, you know, that whole time. I always enjoyed working with you and with some of your clients who typically are trying to make the state work better for working people, right, for disadvantaged That's groups. Right. I admire you and them for that. Glad to be here today.
Thank you. You reminded me about your primary, and what a shocker. You beat the Democratic establishment candidate and you made it into the top two. And that was just, nobody saw that coming, right? It was like, Josh Newman isn't going to be in the general election. Mm-hmm. That must have been a crazy experience to go from the underdog to now you're top two. And all, like you said, the money starts flowing in.
You know, it's a funny thing to be the candidate. And especially, you know, if you're like the outsider guy, you know, nobody gave me a ton of attention or much of a chance, frankly, right? So, you know, there was a guy and who had gotten in much earlier. He'd been the mayor of a town that actually was outside the district, but he bought a house in the district to run. That happens sometimes. And so I, you know, nobody paid me much mind, right? And so I kept trying to get the attention of the political reporter for the local paper. And the only question he would ever ask me, you know, wasn't about what I did or what I was working on. It was about how much money have you raised and, you know, how much money will you raise, that kind of thing. It stayed about the same, surprise, right? We talked. But I, you know, nobody ever asked me, for instance, like, how are you spending that money, right? And so the way we spent my very small amount compared to my opponents, you know, pretty meaningful amount, was, you know, kind of creative marketing, right? So did a bunch of creative things to try and make the case that, you know, people deserve better by way of their elected representation. And there's a guy named Newman, you know, vote for Newman. And so it surprised a lot of people. And one of the, you know, kind of the campaign marketing elements, gimmicks that I was using was I had this idea, which wasn't even, it wound up changing, but I had this idea that if I had a mascot, you know, I could get people to give me their information. And so I bought this bear. This is probably where you're going. So I bought a bear mascot, you know, California bear. So I found some company online that sold college mascot costumes, and I bought a grizzly bear, you know, California grizzly bear costume. The idea was I was going to walk around with somebody, but I realized, you know, I'm gonna have to hire some young kid, you know, off Craigslist or something. The bear costume was actually quite heavy. And so to see if it was a bad idea, I actually went out in the costume myself one day to see if I was going to kill somebody from heat stroke. And I thought it was, you know, I had another kid working for me take a picture of me. And when I finished second in the primary, that picture, which I had on my website, wound up being in the paper, right? They, you know, the red, orange county red shoes, that picture. And it somehow got sort of transformed. This idea got sort of gained traction that I had walked around all primary in this bear costume, and you know that I was
definitely the lore. Yeah,
yeah, you know, yeah. So up in Sacramento, where you know there's 80 assembly districts, there's 40 senate districts. It's hard for political people to know who's who, and so that was the one thing that they knew about me. You know, based on the coverage after the primary, it was a surprise, obviously, that I'd finished in the top two. You know, that still kind of follows me around. When I made the mistake, I think after I got elected, where Alexei Kosev, who was then writing, I think, for the Bee, interviewed me. And at one point, you know, it was about the bear thing. And I said something to the effect of, like, I'm not that kooky, right? You know, because look at me, I'm actually kind of generic. And so that was the he used that as the headline. Like, I'm not that kooky. So it's not all good, but it's probably also true that, you know, elected people shouldn't take themselves too seriously. And money shouldn't be the be all end all in politics. I'm pretty proud that I use these kind of whimsical things in the service of what I still think is a very serious sort of proposition, which is I think people deserve to know who's running to be able to choose the best person to represent them, especially at the state level.
That's right. I think that's why we've always been friends, because we both have that kind of idealistic streak in us that we actually think government should work for the people. You know, just the unsexy work of making government better. And, you know, I mean, that's the point of the podcast and all the content that I do is around people understanding what happens in Sacramento. How does this place work? And because it's not right when you don't know that, you know, as a common citizen or whatever.
Right. And I always point out, you know, so if you see your elected legislator, right, your assembly member or your state senate person, typically if you're most likely to run into them at a, you know, a parade, right, or at a dinner, you know, where they're up on the stage and they get acknowledged, or they're down, somebody says, oh, we're so lucky to have Senator Newman here. And so people might think it's so glamorous to be, you know, an elected official. If you're doing the job well, to your point, it's pretty unglamorous. You know, it's you know, you're on committees. Your office, if you're doing the job well, is doing constituent work for people who, for instance, have trouble with their unemployment, you know, those kinds of things, or their taxes. And then oversight, right? You're trying to make sure that everybody gets full value for their money. And just as importantly, and this is some things that you and I've worked on, that everybody is properly included in, you know, the priorities that we make as a state. But you're right. Not sexy.
So I feel like just from the get-go, your election in 2016, the fact that you made it into the top two is a lesson for advocates in and of itself, which is, you know, don't make assumptions, and people can buck the establishment and make it into office. I mean, it doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen. Tarnish that veneer of, you know, you can't take on the mainstream because you'll never make it or whatever. And listen, 9 times out of 10, that might be true simply because of the financial factor, which you said, money, right? Money is everything when you're running.
But money's a lot. Money's a lot. I mean, I'd like to think it's not everything, but money sure is. I mean, it's a lot. I mean, you know, there's 80 assembly districts, 500,000 people, give or take, in each. So even if you just went to like Kinko's and made copies, it's, you know, it's still expensive.
Yes. So moving into now your time in the building, you know, I've obviously never been elected. I have never even worked in the building, but I have, you know, had the experience of just being an advocate and someone on the outside trying to break through the din of incessant crises and people and talking and word. And how do I make my words count? In a way that somebody else's might not count. And just your perspective, I think now having sat in that position of being someone who is listening to advocates and what you find to be effective versus, you know, totally ineffective.
It's an interesting question. So it's sort of a given that in a state this big with as many challenges and many diverse kind of constituencies, whether that's people or industry groups or advocacy groups, you know, there's just a lot. So we expect a lot. That's why, again, I think it's really important that we as voters, you know, give as much thoughtful deliberation to the people we elect, right? Because we're hiring them to do this. So if you vote on popularity, if you vote only on party, you know, you might not be getting the most diligent or thoughtful representatives. But, you know, what you have in California is you have a legislature that's actually proportionally really small, especially compared to other states. We are the largest state in the country, and we have a legislature that's smaller than many smaller states, with 40 members of the Senate, 80 members of the Assembly. I once made the mistake of telling my wife, like, if there's 40 people in the Senate for 1 million people, that makes me 1 in 1 million. And she is not dumb. She was like, you ran against two other people. You're 1 in 3. But we have, you know, people tend to assume like, wow, if you got elected in California, you must somehow deserve it or you've earned it. And, you know, that's not always true. The people in politics are not the same as the people not in politics.
Yeah.
And every district is different. People come from different directions. The dynamics are different. So the challenge of advocates is, you know, you've got to get the attention of 40 people over here, 80 people over here that are really attention you know, sort of, they have a huge attention deficit. Yeah. There's not a lot of time in the day to, you know, to make time. So, you know, what you're looking for in your legislators, you want people who are, you know, sort of reasonably accomplished, well-versed, lifelong learners, fast learners, and diligent students, if you will. Because, you know, as an example, I think we introduced over 2,000 bills last year and voted on more than 1,000. And they're all important to somebody, but it's not a given that every legislator is well-versed in each of the votes they're making, even in committee, even frankly, of their own bills. And, you know, we can get to why that is so. So for people trying to make an impact on the legislature, either on behalf of an issue, on behalf of a particular policy, you know, idea or proposal, it's really about, you know, making sure that you get in front of the actual person, right? The actual legislator.
Right.
And I think I differ from some other people that, you know, say like, oh, you know, go meet with staff, somebody's chief of staff or policy expert. You can do that, but it's not super likely that that staffer is going to have the same amount of time then to brief the member. If at best, it'll get distilled down into like a paragraph. Worst, it'll be a recommendation, like if and when this bill comes, met with Christina's and her group, vote yes, you know, vote aye, vote no. So it's really about getting in front of as many members as possible and making an issue matter to them. Which is to say, making clear why it matters to you and why it matters to the state and why it should matter to them as a representative of the state.
So I'm going to interject because I love where you're going with this, because this is like the immediate first question, first challenge most advocates face. They can't get in front of the member. There's gatekeepers every which way you turn. You know, I mean, I've experienced the frustration of the members voting on this tomorrow. Can we get 5 minutes of their time? Mm-hmm. And I get that you know, as a member, you're being called a million directions. You have leadership expectations. And then, of course, your committee requirements and all the things. And like you said, there's only 24 hours in a day. But that's probably, I would say, among the number one problems for these groups, specifically folks who don't live and breathe the Capitol. So they don't maybe have name recognition.
Right.
They may be a constituent of yours. So you may know them if they did a good job in the district reaching out and making themselves known to you. But that isn't true for everybody else. And so how do we begin to get past that? Knowing that there's no magic wand here.
Right. You know? And, you know, there is no magic wand. But I think you've touched on something important. The imperative is to get in front of that member as far in advance as possible. And so it is probably true that if it's the day before the vote, and, you know, let's say it's a committee vote, you know, there's probably 10, 11 things on that committee agenda. So, you know, at best, you're getting 10% of that member's attention at best. But if it's an issue that's important to one of their constituents, it shouldn't be that hard, you know, to get in front of them at some point in the district, right, or in Sacramento. But you got to give enough space that they won't have the excuse, like, hey, you know, swamp, can't do it, clock's ticking, and then it's too late. Well, you know, once the vote's taken, it doesn't change much. But it's probably also true that if it's important to one set of constituents in my district, there's probably another set of constituents. I mean, this is about advocacy broadly.
Right.
There's probably constituents in virtually every district. Or most, for whom this is equally important. And so if you have a good kind of holistic strategy on this, not that, you know, it is reasonable to try and get in front of that member. Every office is different. Every member sort of has a different approach to service. I will always err on the side of probably giving too much time to constituents, bugs my staff. But I found that's the only way that I can really learn about issues. But it provides the best insight into the impact of these issues as well.
Right. Well, you know, I just had a interview recently with Senator Gonzalez for the podcast. And, you know, she and you, I think, are cut from the same cloth in terms of erring on the side of giving too much time, or I should say, flowing with the opportunities to speak to constituents directly, even if it interferes with your other duties, because you want to get that inside, you know, lived experience take on it. But I'm sad to say, I don't think that's the norm. Speaking bluntly, I don't think so.
No, well, I don't know. I mean, I'll bet you could ask most legislators and they would tell you the same thing, right? Like, you know, it's sort of like, you know, that thing where like you job interview question, like, what's your biggest flaw? And people say, I care too much about everything. You know, like not everybody does. But it's also true that structurally there are problems. You and I have talked a little about this. I mean, you know, we do too many bills as a legislature.
Oh,
we have We have too many people on too many committees, which stretches people way too thin. So, you know, I'm among a group of people that I think are, next coming year, are going to advocate for reducing the, you know, the bill quota. And then I've been sort of a vocal advocate within my caucus to say, like, hey, you know, people don't need to be on five committees. There might be too much. And we don't need to have committees that have 17 people on them, because that creates a tremendous burden for advocates to get to a majority of those people. But like you said, there's no magic wand, but there is value in diligence, right? There is value in tenacity. And there's especially value in, I think, narrative. And so, you know, telling your story well, especially around kind of its impact and its constituents to members, so that when they vote, they have that as context.
What I also heard you say is the value of coalition building, so that you're reaching other constituents in other districts and uniting around something that everyone is sharing in common. Right. Where do you think folks in your caucus are with this concept of bill introduction limits? I'm curious if that's a popular take.
Geez, you know, it's one of these things where nobody will argue against it, but very few people will step up to embrace it. It reminds me of that saying, like, everybody complains about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. So,
right.
You know, it's same principle kind of applies. And I think it's really a leadership imperative to say, hey, you know, we as a body, or each of the houses, are going to sacrifice a little bit by way of latitude.
I'm on the bill limit campaign team for sure.
but the weird thing is, you know, everybody is, and yet we never do anything about it. I think I guess the analogy that I've always thought makes sense is, you and I go out to dinner with a bunch of people, and somebody says at the beginning, like, hey, everybody, we're all going to split the bill evenly no matter what you get, right? Yeah. You know, so nobody says, I just got a salad, I'm not paying. So everybody's, I'll take the lobster, I'll take the steak. Like, everybody's going to, you know, eat more. And that's kind of what we're doing now with these bill quotas being so high. If we made them lower, I think everybody would benefit.
Right. And you'd be more discerning with what it is you're introducing. I totally agree.
Right. And just importantly, I would have more, you know, mind space talk about other people's bills. Because often, as an advocate, you come to me not because it's my bill. That would be easy for my bill. I'm either for you or against you. But I'm on a committee with 10 other people. There's 11 of us. And you're trying to get my attention for your bill that I'm just learning about. Maybe I don't know about. The fewer bills I have to learn about, the more likely we're going to have a good conversation.
That's just the practical realities of when you don't have bill introduction limits, you have legislators who are supposed to be vetting, you know what, over 2,000 bills. And in the grand scheme of human ability to comprehend, you know, there's just real problems there. Like, you can't get deep on all of that. You don't have enough hours in the day. You don't mind, you know, bandwidth to do that.
And I think it's really important to note, you know, like, how the legislative process works. It's very, you know, sort of end heavy. And by that, I mean, you know, we work over the course of a year, and it's prescribed differently. You know, it's different than the congressional way. In Congress, bills can kind of go on their own cycle. But in the legislature, like, you know, February 15th, give or take, is the submission deadline. And then there's a whole process. I mean, a series of gates, you know, policy gates, appropriations, the floor. Mm-hmm. But then everything sort of comes to the end of this cycle in September, the end of August, first half of September. And so we as a legislature wind up voting on all of these bills as a huge pile. And so there are days where, you know, at the end of session, we're voting for 100 bills. And there is nobody smart enough to be fully prepared.
That's right.
Except in the kind of the most basic kind of cliff note way about, like, all of the, you know, the different ramifications, unintended side effects, the nuances of a bill. That's a big deal. And that's important, I think, for advocates to remember. Unless you're really, really lucky and it gets signed and moved to the governor really early, it's going to be part of this massive kind of tidal wave of legislation that happens at the end of the year.
Yes, 100%. And I think it's just the reality of governing. We have this kind of like school kid notion, you know, all these things, these deliberative bodies, but then there's the practical reality of no human being can absorb 100 different complex issues and know them in and out.
I think like the conventional wisdom, like, you know, the rule of thumb is in psychology that each of us on average can hold like 7 ideas in our head
at once, right?
So it's not 100. It's not 100.
Right.
So the truth is, I can't even remember some days my own bill numbers. Every bill gets a number. And somebody will say, you know, what about 592? And I'll be like, well, Bill, you know, I don't know.
What does that do, right?
What bill is that?
What it points to, going back to the advocate perspective, is you're marketing a product to a consumer. And when you take into account all of these things that you're talking about, and that you've got the limited attention, you've got the too many bills, you've got the, you know, I'm reading the analysis and I'm trying to digest, but I can't, and all of those things, right? The reality of it, it behooves the advocate to speak therefore in a certain way, to be as concise as possible, to get to the freaking point. If you have 15 minutes with a member, you shouldn't be spending 14 of them shooting the shit about, you know, the movie you saw last week, or getting deep into the statistics or this or that, in the sense that what is the most important thing that person needs to know in that short period of time? The concept of an elevator pitch is very real. And the concept of using marketing principles is, to me, very real.
So I agree. I actually, Chris, you know, one of the bits of advice that I give to groups, you know, when they come on their lobbying day, right, they do their advocacy day, is exactly that, like get to the point. The reason for that is, I mean, if you ask the question, like, we got 120 legislators, they're all from different places, they all have one thing in common, and that is they're probably really good at small talk. And so what you see quite often is legislator comes in late because they're coming from somewhere the last meeting, right, or you came in late because the last meeting took a while. And then you do a bunch of small talk about where you're from. Do you know so-and-so? Do you, you know, my kid went to high school. And next thing you know, the scheduler comes in and like only 5 minutes left, right? And then the legislator, oh, gee, I'm sorry, we don't have more time, right?
Oh,
exactly.
Well.
And I'll say this, I don't think 15 minutes is sufficient to have a conversation about anything substantive.
To begin with, right.
And so I don't do 15-minute meetings. And if I'm advising people, I would say don't try not to accept 15-minute meetings. 30 minutes should be enough if you get to the point to say, you know, hey, Mr. Senator, here's the problem. Here's our proposed solution. Here's who it impacts. Here's some things to consider. Right. Here's the vote you're going to take. Yeah.
Here's your opposition. You know, so there's no surprises at the end of the day, too.
Right, right.
This is what they're going to say. This is why they're wrong. You know, when they come to you, think about this element or whatever.
Right.
I guess it's the principle that, you know, a lot of advocates have, that because an idea is a good one, it could be the most meaningful, data-driven, best practice, every reason in the world why it should be made into public policy, which I respect 100,000%. Like, I'm not poo-pooing any of that. Mm-hmm. But that isn't enough, because there's 100 other bills that have the same thing going on. And so how do you package what you're trying to do in a way that takes into account the reality of being a lawmaker? And that's not, no judgment, that's not, you know, a critique necessarily. It's just the reality that, you know, in a state as big as this, with a legislature as small as this, this is what you're dealing with. And how do you get around that? What is your messaging? What are your talking points? You know, what's your soundbite? Like, good campaigns have soundbites. They just do.
Right.
You know, what is one sentence that explains the essence of what this is about?
I think I've learned to do it is, you know, sort of problem solution. Well, what's the problem that needs solving?
Yeah.
And then what's our proposed solution? And if you really thought about it, you'll give yourself a little leeway for, you know, modification, because, you know, the legislative process is pretty merciless, you know, as far as how it changes an idea. Right. Same as, you know, no movie is the same as its original idea after that process. Legislative process has something similar. By the end, you know, it's going to probably change in some ways. But if you allow for that, I think you can kind of manage that process well.
Every year you see bills get vetoed, at least in my experience, bills get vetoed with the simple explanation that money wasn't allocated in the budget to pay for the bill. But you every year see bills going to the governor that don't have money in the budget. Why do you think members don't seem to be pursuing the funding for their bills? Or not all of them do. I've sensed this almost trepidation or intimidation with the budget process in general.
It's a good kind of interesting question. You know, the budget process is one thing, you know, complicated, done on one timeline. And then the legislative process is a very often a very different thing. But to the extent that the things we propose cost money and that money comes from the budget, it's really important to align those two processes. So I think what you do see is you see experienced legislators are sort of attentive to that and take that into account. But new legislators typically think kind of misguided. So if I can keep the conversation away from money, I'm more likely to get my bill through. But and so, you know, there, and there's a section of code 28.8, and we refer it, which says that if something doesn't have fiscal impact, it doesn't have to go through the appropriations step. So people are always hoping, like, you know, oh, this will get, we call it 28.8, but it'll go straight through, you know, to the floor to the next house without having to go through that appropriation step. And for your listeners, you know, the appropriations process is kind of, you know, what it's supposed to be, I should say. But what it's supposed to be is it, you know, takes all the bills that have a fiscal impact and it aggregates them together so that we as a legislature can then correlate the gross cost against our revenues, against our fiscal capacity. And then within that, prioritize. You know, so if the budget is X 1 year, you got to make sure you're not making commitments well beyond that simply because you think all this legislation is terrific. It's how it's supposed to work. There's a political dimension to the appropriations process that has nothing to do with that. That it's probably the most vexing part of my job. You know, for certain, you know, for groups where you had a great bill that dies in appropriations, nobody has to tell you why. But that's part of it. But because, again, because those, you know, not aligned cycles, and it's also about how, you know, it's a big state. So if you propose to do something that you want to do in all 58 counties, it's going to cost millions of dollars, even if that's just staff time somewhere. And, you know, millions of dollars against billions isn't a lot, but if you multiply millions by 1,000 bills, you get to big numbers. And so these are problems. And the budget process itself is really opaque and kind of complicated. In the, you know, in January of every year, the governor introduces a proposed budget. The legislature actually allocates funds, sort of a conversation, negotiation between the governor and the legislature. But that goes through June. We don't pass bills until September. And so, you know, often during the legislative process, governor's staff, Department of Defense will say, like, you know, this is a bad idea because it will cost too much. We can't do it. But, you know, half the time it'll just keep moving. And so everybody will get all excited about solving a problem. And then at the end, the governor will veto it and say, like, this is, you know, a well-intentioned effort for which there is not sufficient fiscal capacity or something to that effect.
This is such a valuable conversation because nobody talks about the intricacies of the budget timeline and the bill timeline, the role that appropriations is supposed to play versus the role that budget committee plays, and then how it actually works in real life. Going back to the new members in the budget process, I think what you said was really interesting. There's a thought that if I just stay under this threshold, I'll escape suspense file. Or if I just don't talk about the fiscal too much, then nobody will pay attention to it, even though the Department of Finance is literally analyzing the shit out of everything.
Right. But there's probably another piece to it, which is like, so if I'm a relatively new member and, you know, I support kind of your priorities and we work with you and you say, hey, we've got an idea to do something. I say, let's do it. You know, it's hard for me, absent the kind of Department of Finance input, like, I don't know how much that costs. And on some level, like, I probably have an interest to not ask that question because, well, you know, what if you did? It's like, hey, Christine, I'm going to take this bill on behalf of your constituents or a group that you support and let's do it. Right. And then if I came back and said, hey, by the way, I did a little research and it's going to cost $80 million, I'm not doing it. And you would say, I think reasonably, like, so what? It's really important.
Yeah.
And I probably is. And again, in a state where our, you know, sort of general fund obligations are like $300 billion. I mean, this really is the question, which is how do we prioritize when it comes to bills? Like, if something's important enough to pass, it should be important enough to fund.
Well, yeah. I think it goes back to that's why you have to ask for an appropriation in the budget process. This is what makes it confusing. Every year, the governor does sign bills that cost money, and they find the money.
They find the money, right? They absolutely,
you know, they find it. It's either absorbed internally or who knows, or it's a bill that says upon appropriation so that the bill actually is signed, but until you go next year to the budget and get money, it's not being implemented.
That could go one of two ways. You know, that can come with, you know, sort of a general commitment or expectation that the money will be found in the next budget year, or the onus is on you to go.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's how I would understand it. Right.
Yeah.
So it goes back to this reality of, like, so advocates need to know and members should know that $1 billion is never going to go unnoticed. Even $1 million won't go unnoticed in my experience. And all that happens is a terrible veto message. And then you're disappointed and you've worked so damn hard and all of the things. But it's not as certain. Again, there are times where, you know, the governor has signed big bills, but that's an outlier.
So part of the advocacy lesson here is, to the extent possible, if you can have the support of members, not just of the legislative branch, like me as the author and whatever, but like some level of mind share and support in the executive branch, you know, you're that much more likely to have the right outcome. And we often, we work on a bill and lobby a bill, it's completely focused on the legislative component. And that often gets you to where, you know, kind of that worst case scenario where like the governor, I can't do this. The other thing to learn is it's not easy, but it's actually quite possible to find the right people within the administration who have oversight or an interest in a particular issue. And so you can bring them to it earlier, it makes you know, that much more likely that, that you, money won't be the excuse for it.
If you think about it, you need a champion in the administration, you need a champion in the Senate, in the assembly, and this all has to align. It's a pretty Herculean process.
Oh, totally. And a lot, sometimes, frankly, and often it has nothing to do with money per se. It has to do with who gets credit for the idea. You know, there is that in the budget. The budget proposal is a bunch of proposals from one side of the house. And then we come back with ours and, you know, nobody looks the same at somebody else's ideas at your own. Like, my ideas are awesome. Somebody else's idea, like, you know, if I'm not, I can figure out reasons why I wouldn't want to do that. So, you know, it's really about, to your point about narrative marketing, it's about getting people to buy in and ownership.
Well, I've done episodes that are just on the budget process. And my favorite, well, I have several favorites, actually. I did one with former Senator Cum Lager, now Congress member, when she was sub three chair in the Senate. We came up with this metaphor. It's like an ensemble, right? It's like putting on a show. There's a whole bunch of people who do a whole bunch of different things. And you really need to talk to all of them. Because at the end of the day, it's like everyone's checking. Like, are you good? Does this work for you? And that process is exhausting. Budget advocacy is very hard and very tiring. And
exhausting.
People assume that everybody knows how the budget process works. It's just not true. You know, definitely on the staff level, definitely on the member level. If you're looking for money, find someone who knows how to do this stuff.
Right.
Because it's just not the same.
It's, you know, on some level, like that's what it's really about, right? I mean, that's in a state this big, you want to make a difference on a particular problem. It's going to cost money. It's real money. And it's got to come from somewhere.
I want to be respectful of your time. This has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your insight. It's very valuable, like I said.
Insights, maybe not expertise, but
you're an expert in being a state senator.
Maybe. So I've really enjoyed it, and I always enjoy working with you, Christine.
If you're finding this show to be valuable, please go ahead, hit that subscribe button, share episodes with your networks, and send me your feedback. I really appreciate that. I will link to my socials in the show notes. Thank you very much, and I will talk with you soon. Hey.